What does it mean to be a Western yogi? How can someone who was born and raised in the West, who comes from a Judeo-Christian background, practice yoga and meditation in an authentic and genuine way? My name is Christopher Sartain, and this is the Western Yoga Podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Western Yoga Podcast. I'm honored to be joined today by my dear friend Ryan Strong, fellow Kriya Yoga teacher and Ayurveda practitioner, and also a practitioner of Jyotisha, or Vedic astrology, Jyotish. And so welcome, Ryan. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
So Ryan and I are both disciples or students of Roy Eugene Davis, our spiritual teacher. And if you've noticed, the past couple of episodes have also featured other students of Mr. Davis who are currently teaching Kriya Yoga independently and good friends of mine. And so I wanted to feature some of my friends and these this series of episodes on the Western Yoga Podcast to share and share a little bit of communion and friendship and spiritual brotherhood. And all three of them, Ryan Kurzak, David McGrath, and now Ryan Strong, are all very inspirational figures for me in my own path. Ryan and I, it's been two years. We had a chance to meditate together a couple of years ago, do a meditation retreat together, rather, a couple of years ago. Ryan Kurzak was also there, and my wife, Carolina. And we had just a wonderful experience that week. I'll never forget Ryan coming to us and saying, "Hey, you guys, there's an eclipse happening. What was it, like 2 a.m. or something?" And I think we already had like a 2 or 3 hour meditation planned for the following morning or something. He said, "Yeah, there's this eclipse, you know, happening. It'd be cool to meditate during the eclipse. You know, we'll meditate for a couple of hours. It'll be a lot of fun." this is my kind of guy, you know. Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun. That's like not the first word that, you know, came to my mind waking up that early and meditating, but lo and behold, it was a really great experience.
And
we even got to go out and eat some pizza and ice cream. Yep. Remember, we had a big old lactose party.
Yep.
Yeah, it was just a great experience. And so I wanted to have Ryan on today to talk a little bit about Ayurveda. So Ryan, would you mind just sort of describing or defining Ayurveda for some of my listeners who might not be totally familiar?
Yeah, absolutely. Ayurveda means the science of life. The science of life. Ayur is life, and Veda, of course, is knowledge. And so Ayurveda is a sister science to yoga. It complements yoga. So the way I like to think about Ayurveda, it's almost like there is almost an owner's manual to our body and to how to live the best way and take the best care of our ahamkara, or the mind body personality. And so Ayurveda is a science of how to eat and sleep and how to just ways to live that support wellness and health and things like this. Yeah.
And where did you study Ayurveda? And by the way, Ryan lives in California, I should say. And you studied there, right?
It did. I first started to study, I consider my first training really was with Mr. Davis. When I first started to train or to study in Korea, Roy, he was a big proponent of Ayurveda, and he it was extremely knowledgeable of Ayurveda, and he has a great book, An Easy Guide to Ayurveda. And so it really began then. And back then, it was like 1999, the year 2000, right around then, there wasn't a lot of training in the United States. There were two schools at the time. And so I just got like every book I could read on it and started to study then. But I went to school officially. I started to train in California. So I moved from Arizona, Flagstaff, Arizona, to California to go to the California College of Ayurveda. But, you know, even though I moved up here to go to school, I wasn't able to start school right away. You know, I had to get a job and get established. And while I was doing that, I started to study with a pulse doctor, a Ayurvedic teacher, Mary Jo Cravatta. And so I started to learn pulse and Ayurveda with her. And then I went to the California College of Ayurveda and I finished their program. And then I continued to study with other teachers after that. California College is the main school that I was, the official school that I went to. Yeah.
And now what is your, because I know I talked to you previously about the different titles of Ayurvedic practitioners, and I've already forgotten everything you told me. So what is your title?
Yeah, I'm considered to be an Ayurvedic doctor through the National Ayurvedic Medical Association, which is our governing body in the United States or in North America.
And so what are the various titles that or various levels that an Ayurvedic practitioner in the U.S. can have?
So currently there's three. There is the Ayurvedic counselor. And so this is a person that will help really look at the counselors are able to assess your dosha. And that's kind of a complicated thing, I'm sure we might get into a little bit, but they can assess your dosha and then they can give diet and lifestyle recommendations, which is very helpful. And then there is the clinical Ayurvedic practitioner or Ayurvedic practitioner, and their scope of practice is diagnosing vikruti, diagnosing imbalance, and practitioners are able to work on imbalances that might have names that are related to medical diagnoses. So they're not treating Western medical diseases per se, but they're looking at the underlying doshic imbalance that might be causing them, like type 2 diabetes or migraine headaches. And so practitioners are able to work on these things. And then the Ayurvedic doctor is fully trained to assess. They're more skilled in their abilities to deal with more advanced samprati or disease pathologies from an Ayurvedic perspective.
Okay. And if someone comes to you, for example, for a session, what exactly, well, of course, it depends on what kind of issues they're having, but what does that process look like? Like, what are the first couple steps that you guide them through for a session or consultation?
Yeah, it is different for each person, but typically I'll meet with someone, I'll send them a bunch of paperwork or through the email and they'll fill it out and they'll send it back to me and then we'll meet. And I will spend about 90 minutes to 2 hours just going through their whole history, looking at what's happening now, but looking at possible childhood illnesses. And so I get this comprehensive picture of their short-term imbalances, things that are maybe haven't been going on forever, but then looking at their long-term history, assess their body, look at their tongue in person. I will often take their pulse. And so it's a comprehensive intake of looking at everything. And then from that, I will make a diagnosis of their constitution, their prakriti, so what they were born as, but more importantly, what it is today, Vikruti, what is their current state? And then I'll develop a treatment plan. Usually people will come because they have an issue, you know? And so after I assess them, then the first thing is, how do we make this better? And that's going to be different for each person. And so a lot of times it's a path of discovery, you know, it takes a little while to comprehend what our dosha is. It takes a little bit of experimentation to figure out what is the right thing as far as the right foods, the right lifestyle. And so it can be a little bit of an ongoing process for some people. And so it just depends. There's people I've been working with for years. There's people that will come in and I'll work with them for a few sessions. And it just depends. Yeah.
And you want to just give a very brief description of each dosha?
Sure.
Dosha, by the way, and Ayurveda is sort of thought of as being our basic mind-body constitution, or at least that's the way Mr. Davis sort of defined it. And there are three principal, you know, mind-body constitutions that are three categories that people typically tend to fall under. It's never, you know, an exact science. But do you want to explain the three doshas?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so with Ayurveda, everything is based off Samkhya. So looking at the cosmology of how our universe, our physical quote-unquote universe, is made up of the elements, and looking at the five elements. And within our body, these five elements combine to create what we call dosha. And a dosha is roughly defined as fault, and kind of like a fault line. So we'll say dosha builds up in our body and it can cause issues, for example. But even setting that aside, we can see how the elements combine into each dosha. So for example, vata is a combination of ether and air, and everybody has vata. Everybody has ether and air element within them, and vata is the dosha which moves everything. Vata is responsible for all of our nervous system functioning, our how everything moves through our digestive system. It's how we bring in the experience of our outer reality. And so vata is a biological function of our body. Pitta is the combination of fire with a little bit of water. It's mostly fire. And so when we look at pitta, and again, just like vata, everybody has pitta also inside of their body. And pitta is responsible for digestion, all the processes of being able to digest our food, digest our experience, digest light. And its function is about, it creates heat within our body and keeps us warm. And then there's kapha, and kapha is a combination of earth and water. And again, everybody has, just like vata, everybody has vata, the processes of movement. Everybody has pitta, the processes of digestion. And everybody has kapha, which is going to create the solidity, the stability, and the protection of our body. But because of our genetics and our karma, each person is going to be born with what is known as prakriti. Prakriti is our original nature. So at the moment of conception, our dosha is created. And so people will be predominantly vata, pitta, or kapha. They can be a combination of two or a combination of all three. And it's rare for someone, in my experience, to be predominantly more pitta, more vata, or kapha. Most people are a combination. But as I was saying before, everyone has all three. But it can be really helpful to find out what your predominant dosha or doshas are, because then looking at your food and looking at your environment, everything in this world is elemental. And so if we're born with a lot of pitta, we have all this fire within us. And so then we eat foods or behave in, or we engage in behaviors that are cooling. So we're not so hot, for example. But even to make it a little bit more nuanced, so we have our prakriti, which is what we're born with as far as dosha. And then we have our Vikruti, which is our current state. So even in the womb, we are under the influence of all of the elements. So how our mother was feeling, what she was going through, what she was eating, the climate that she was in during that time. So all of these things constantly affect us. And so when we're looking at our dosha, we're looking at what was it originally, but more importantly, or just as important, is what is it today? What is it right now? And so it is a little bit nuanced. It can be. Yeah.
And why is it that, you know, Pitta types tend to be attracted to all this Pitta stuff that provokes Pitta and catalyzes, you know, imbalances of Pitta? Vatas tend to be attracted to Vata stuff. Kaphas tend to be attracted to Kapha stuff. Is it just as simple as saying like attracts like, or is there something more going on there?
Yeah, it is as simple as like attracts like, but there's also, it's interesting to think about it. So with the example, so like, let's say someone that's really Vata, so they have a very sensitive nervous system, and they might have, their mind might be very turbulent, and they might experience anxiety, nervousness. They're just super sensitive, right? And so we would say like, that's an imbalance, because a Vata imbalance is just extremely perceptive, creative, vivacious, and they don't have to experience those symptoms, but the symptoms will reflect on an underlying imbalance. So if we have an imbalance, so if for example, going back to Vata, so that nervousness, that anxiety, the turbulent mind, if we're out of balance, we tend to crave or desire what keeps us out of balance. It's like a Vata will just, I see it all the time, Vatas will be drinking coffee all day, or a Vata might have a diagnosis of having like ADHD symptoms, and they're taking stimulants and this kind of stuff. And I'm not saying anything negative about that, but it is often the case that when we're out of balance, we crave what perpetuates that situation. But just the opposite is true. If we're in balance, we tend to crave the things that keep us in balance too.
Isn't that strange? Yeah. It's counterintuitive. In other words, like you would think, oh, if I'm out of balance, then I would crave those things which might bring me back into balance. And it's just the opposite. And I've noticed this with my yoga students and people that I talk to about lifestyle routines and whatnot. I don't consider myself an Ayurvedic practitioner. I've taken some courses and stuff, but yeah, I've noticed that that's always occurring. You know, that kaphas tend to do a lot of kapha things. You know, that keeps that imbalance happening. Pitta tend to do a lot of pitta things. Vata tend to do a lot of vata things. So, can you talk a little bit about the importance of, because you can give people all the advice in the world, you can give them, you know, a routine to follow, dietary plan, herbs that they're supposed to take, even, you know, breathing techniques, oils, all the stuff. But if they don't have the self-discipline and the self-control and all that to see it through, then none of it really works in the end. So what have you found that works well for helping your clients to improve their lives, improve their balance through some type of disciplined practice?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that can be difficult. This is where sometimes a hard situation. So if somebody's dealing with a health issue, physically or psychologically, then they're often very motivated to get better. And in my practice, I see a lot of folks that have chronic illnesses that are hard to diagnose. And so they've been to this doctor or this person, and they're kind of like, you know, at their wit's end almost. And so sometimes when people are in a hard situation, they're real motivated to make those changes and take those steps. But for a lot of people, you're 100% correct. It is a fact that if you go to an Ayurvedic doctor or practitioner, most of the time they're going to give you a list of foods not to eat. Here's your herbs. Here's your yoga. And they hand you a lot of paperwork, basically. And that's not enough. You know, you can have the keys to the kingdom. This is what you need to do, but how do you help them do that? Yeah. And so that it's a real individual. You have to kind of tune into the individual and know what might motivate them. But more importantly is you break it down into smaller changes. So the idea is we're going to make a small change that's lasting. So it's about creating habits and then following up and saying, how did you do with that? And if they're doing well, then it's great. Let's move on. Let's add to it. But if they're not doing well with it, it's like, what got in the way? Why couldn't you go to bed before 10:30, you know? And then to find out the reasons. And then it's all about this kind of, when I was in school, we called it creative solutions or creative support. And this is the hardest thing to do, but it's the most important, is finding out how to help someone, how to encourage them, how to look at what are the reasons why, and really counseling them step by step of how to move through that. And so it's, you're right. It's a hard one, but it is very individual.
And I talked to you also about one time about people coming to you or coming to Ayurvedic practitioners in general with very sort of lofty, unrealistic expectations for what to expect. I think you gave me the example of, I think there was a guy that had like a missing vertebrae or something one time, you know, and it's like, there are certain things that, you know, and we have these ideas also with meditation.
Yeah.
That meditation's going to solve all your problems. Kriya yoga is going to solve all your problems. I thought that when I, you know, first got on this Kriya yoga path, I thought, oh, well, if I just practice this every day, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to have this great, perfect life. I won't have any health issues. You know, I'll be super happy and blissed out all the time. So how do you cultivate realistic expectations in your clients that you work with?
Yeah. It's another really hard, like, good question. And it's hard to answer because each person will have different. So sometimes it's just the opposite, where you want to raise their expectations. There's so many people that can get better. They can see the results. They can live in such a better way with more ease, you know, less symptoms. And people that there's a lot of folks that are attached to their illness. It's defining them, right? So it's like their sense of self is connected to the story, and without the story, without the illness, they don't know who they are. And they can do this unconsciously and sometimes even consciously. I'll never forget working with someone who was dealing with Lyme's disease. And she said, at a certain point, she said, if this gets better, then I'm going to have to get a job and my family is no longer going to support me. And so I find it to be even more true to inspire people towards their higher self and seeing that they can get better. But then, you know, as far as unrealistic expectations, I'm very clear with that. You know, you'll get people that come in and they have a tumor, you know, they're dying of cancer or these kind of things. And they are, for a lot of good reasons, not wanting to seek medical treatment. And so sometimes I'm having to tell people, go to the doctor. Sometimes I'm having to say, hey, you could really use this treatment. This might, and not to make that decision for them, but to really kind of let them see that this isn't magical. I don't have a magic wand. Ayurveda doesn't have a magic wand. And a matter of fact, every single one of us will die. Right. This body has, yeah, it's true. It's true. We have an expiration.
I thought if I meditated every day and, you know, and had a good vegetarian diet that I would never get sick or die.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. That's not
it.
True. I mean, I've never met someone that wasn't true for. I've read about people that wasn't true for, but I've never met them.
Huh.
Yeah. And it's within the Ayurvedic community, there are people that promote this. You know, there's these secret mantras, there's these secret herbs, you know, you got to go to India and meet these, and all these things can be helpful, but to promise miracles is unethical.
It's unethical. That's right.
Unethical. Yeah.
How have you seen Ayurveda evolving in the West? I mean, obviously you're a Westerner, you live in California, you know, you're an American practitioner. And I'm sure you've spoken with, you know, Ayurvedic practitioners from India. What differences have you noticed between maybe how, you know, folks in India practice Ayurveda versus folks in the West?
Yeah, India is incredibly diverse, and there are traditions within India, especially within families, where the knowledge and the training is passed down, you know, and sometimes some of these doctors or Vaidyas started to train when they were really young. And so their knowledge and experience of Ayurveda is so vast, and it goes back generations. And so that's very powerful, but that's even, although that is in India, it is more rare than what is normally practiced in India, which is kind of a hybrid model of allopathic medicine and Ayurveda. So you go to school, you learn Western anatomy, physiology, and it's almost like like 2 years of med school almost, and then you learn Ayurveda. And so Ayurveda in India is mostly practiced like this. It's a meeting of allopathic Western medicine concepts and herbalism, Ayurveda, and it's interesting even within that, because some of the subtle and spiritual elements of Ayurveda are kind of removed. Not with everyone, but a lot of folks that practice Ayurveda, they're not really concerned at all with the spiritual or subtle or metaphysical aspects of it, which is interesting. Where in the West, there tends to almost be too much of a focus on the metaphysical, spiritual, which is really important. And in the West, or in the United States, you know, Americans are so good at marketing, you know, and so the same situation that's happened with asana or yoga, as far as being marketed to the demographic of white women between the age of 40 and 60, and then it becomes marketed and packaged, and so it's become something very different than what it is in India or other places within the world. Although there are practitioners from India practicing here, there's some incredible schools, there's incredible Ayurvedic doctors and practitioners. That is absolutely true here. But there's also a lot of people they mean well, but they're not trained. They don't have the knowledge or expertise to practice Ayurveda effectively. And so, unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of that in the United States right now.
And there in California, if someone wanted to do Panchakarma, are there Panchakarma clinics or retreat centers available for folks out there?
There are. Oh yeah, there's many. There should be more, but there are many of them, and some of them are very good. Yeah, and I practice Pancha.
Mm-hmm. What is Panchakarma for people that might be interested in doing like a very deep sort of detox therapy?
Yeah, Panchakarma is one of the most effective ways to restore someone's health. And it's a process, and it's also an art form. most Panchakarma in the United States is more of like Panchakarma light, where you would work with a practitioner and you change your diet for a few days and take some herbs for a few days. And then you get like a week of like spa treatments. And that can be wonderful. You know, people are stressed and this has a place. But true Panchakarma is the process of preparing the body over a period of time to loosen up the excess dosha. So if it's Vata, Pitta, or mostly Vata or Kapha, but it's also helpful in balancing Vata, but it's loosening up the dosha and loosening up toxins, ama that's built up in the system, and removing it from the body. And so Panchakarma is the most effective way to cleanse the body. But then, unlike a lot of cleanses, quote unquote, Panchakarma is not complete until we rebuild and strengthen. And so the one part of it is purifying, reducing. It's called Shodhana, it's cleansing. And then another part is Brahmana Chikitsa, strengthening, Rasayana, and strength or building. And so I don't know if I explained it very well, but it's an incredible process of cleansing the body and strengthening it, and really strengthening the metabolism, strengthening the digestive fire and the Agni. And you can do this as a preventative measure too. I work with people that do this twice a year. They go through Panchakarma in the spring, they go through Panchakarma and in the fall, and they're doing pretty good, but they do this just to keep that balance.
I had a friend that went and did Panchakarma for 2 weeks in Kerala, India.
Yeah.
And I guess there's a bunch of clinics there. And he wasn't allowed to have his cell phone with him. Like he, you know, couldn't watch TV, listen to the radio. I think he had a couple books with him or something, but literally like that he said it was very strict. I'm wondering, you know, in California or in the US, is it that kind of process? Is there like a digital detox involved as well, or?
Yeah, it depends on each place and how they do it. Because a lot of places, you're not staying there. You're staying near there. So you get like a hotel or Airbnb, and then you travel to the clinic.
Oh, okay.
But the best Panchakarmas are residential, where you are there and you are taken care of. Your food is brought to you. The treatments are brought to you. Your clothes are cleaned. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of put in this womb-like experience.
That's the way he described it. Yeah, he couldn't leave his room for 2 weeks. Yeah. In the same room for 2 weeks. They, you know, he asked them, you know, can I go for a walk? No walks, no exercise. Like, you're just going to rest. You're going to rest.
Yeah, that's ideal. I mean, that's really ideal.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it can be. No, you have to be a little bit careful. Hmm. I'll never forget the first person, one of the first true Panchakarmas I did with someone. It was 14 days. I was working at the California College of Ayurveda. And so it's a beautiful facility. And it was just amazing what we had. And what I could prescribe and see happen was amazing. But so she gets to the clinic, and I had recommended, you know, you can check in with your family. So she would do that, but she started having all of these conflicts. So she'd be on the phone, she's worried about her daughter, and there's all this stuff happening. And so checking in with her every day, one of the days I was talking to her, I recommended that she limit her call. I said, maybe just do 15 minutes, you know? And so then about 3 days later, I get a call from her husband, and he's like, did you tell her not to talk to me? And I said, no. And it was all good. It was fine. But, you know, they didn't know what Panchakarma was. Here she is going to California and doing this thing. And it almost seemed like she had joined a cult to her family or something like that. But digital detoxes and all that stuff are really important for most people. But a lot of places don't insist on it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Can you just give my listeners maybe just a couple of very simple things that they can all do regardless of their dosha? Simple you know, dietary protocols that they could follow in their daily lives that might lead to more balance and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the most helpful things that we can do, so we evolved on this planet, and our bodies evolved on this planet. And so it is our biorhythms, our circadian rhythms. So like everything, all of our hormones, and the hormones regulate our nervous system, and our nervous system regulates our hormones. And all of this is in sync with the natural rhythms of light. And that light changes, of course, throughout the year, and it depends on where we live. But if we want better balance mentally, physically, even emotionally, it is a great idea to wake up before the sun. To wake up before, for some people, you know, maybe it's an hour or half hour, but just for everyone, if you can wake up before the sun comes up. And then if you can get the morning light, even if it's cloudy, if you can expose your eyes, if you can see, to get the light, and doing this as a regular habit has a profound effect on our well-being, our physical and emotional states. Helps if you're dealing with hormonal issues, mood disorders, and the list goes on and on. And this is backed up by science. But again, if you can wake up in the morning early and get that morning light, even for a couple minutes, don't stare at the sun, but get the morning light and keep that as a habit, you will find that this is one of the most helpful things that you can do. Another helpful thing that everyone can do is to not eat before bed. The idea is, if you go to bed at 10 or if you go to bed at 9, give yourself at least 3 hours before you go to bed. So take that dinner earlier and give yourself 3 hours at least before you're in bed. And if possible, dinner should be a lighter dinner. You know, so many people are accustomed to eating the biggest meal of the day at night. But if you're dealing with health challenges, energy issues, sleep disorders, try this. Have a smaller, lighter dinner, something that's soupy, something that's warm and yummy. Take it earlier in the evening. Give yourself 3-4 hours before you go to sleep. Practice this and notice how it might really improve your well-being. Yeah.
Yeah, I've noticed that in my own life. Whenever I eat late, I have major digestive issues the next morning, and I guess I have a pretty sensitive digestive system. But not only that, but I feel heavier, more sluggish, slower.
Yeah,
I've noticed that if I do, you know, not even intermittent fasting, but let's say 14, 15 hours in between my dinner and my breakfast, I have more energy. And also, I don't get overweight as easily. Yeah. That's another issue is when folks eat late, they don't digest their food as well. They don't burn as many calories, obviously, and they tend to gain weight much more quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I've been listening to this. I don't know if you know about the Huberman podcast. Have you heard this?
I do. Yeah, it was funny. When I was talking about the morning light. He did pop into my mind. Yeah.
Yeah, he talks about that all the time, and I'm like, is that real? You know? And so I did some research into it, and sure enough, like, yeah, it has a major influence on your dopamine, serotonin levels and all this kind of
melatonin
stuff.
It's amazing. It's incredibly helpful. And there's so many studies on it. And Ayurveda has promoted this for millennia.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Well, they knew all this, they've known all this stuff for thousands of years that we're just proving with science or whatever. But it's also a great time to meditate, you know, sunrise and sunset. It's not by coincidence, in other words, that yogis chose that time, those two times of day, you know, Absolutely. To do their fire ceremonies originally, but then their you know, meditation practice or pranayama practice or what have you. There is a sort of, there is more balance, I find, between Agni and Soma, you know, solar energies, lunar energies, Ida, Pingala, and all that.
Right.
At the sunrise and the sunset, and we can sort of like take advantage of that equilibrium, that energetic sort of equilibrium or balance, to promote, you know, our meditation practice, our well-being, and all of that.
Because we again, like, we like to think of ourselves as separate from the system, but we, every part of our, all of this, this body evolved in this system. So the more we can live in a way that's in alignment with it, it supports all of our functioning.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ryan, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was great talking with you.
Taking the time out. It's always great to connect with you. And like I said at the beginning, it's really important for me to maintain, you know, these spiritual friendships I have with my brother disciples, you know. Sure. And I look at you guys and girls, women, and you know, Jesus said in the Bible, there's a verse, something about you will know them by their fruits. And he was talking about prophets and false prophets and, you know, spiritual teachers. And he said, you will know them by their fruits. And so if we apply that to Mr. Davis and what he produced as this fruit giving tree, this life giving spirit, as he used to say in his older books, you know, and I look at the fruits that spiritual tree has produced, and you know, Ryan Kurzak, David McGrath, yourself, and many others, of course. It's just remarkable that that we got to spend time with this enlightened being. You know, we got to spend part of our lives, you know, I was really only spent a lot of time with them for 11 years or something, like 12 years maybe, but some of y'all, you know, for much longer than that. But even if you just spent, you know, a couple of years learning from him, or even if you were just in his presence for, you know, one or two retreats or whatever,
even if you just met him,
it's just unbelievable that spiritual influence, or that transmission. You know, yoga really, we focus so much on the practices, which are super important, obviously. But I don't think enough is said about that transmission that occurs from an enlightened being to their students, a few of whom, you know, go through their own awakening process, and this Shakti is awakened in them via the Shakti pot of the teacher and all this, and then they go out and they teach and have their own students and all that. This is how this is supposed to work. It's this uninterrupted chain, this unbroken chain of transmission that occurs. And so when I look out there, you know, at Mr. Davis's students who are now teachers, it's quite apparent that this transmission continues. And we're just so unbelievably blessed. You know, we were talking before the podcast about, you know, some of the ups and downs that we go through in life, and some of the trials and tribulations and all these things. But you're saying, yeah, but dude, you've had such a blessed life. And sometimes I forget that, and I don't feel it, and I'm not experiencing it. But it's good to hear that from people like you, you know, because looking back, you're right. I've had a ridiculously blessed life. You know, we all have, all of us who got to spend time learning from Mr. Davis, meditating with Mr. Davis, receiving this transmission. That's just, it's unbelievable. You want to speak just a couple minutes in closing about your time with Mr. Davis, or that transmission, or anything I just said there?
Yeah. I don't know when this will go out, but you know, today is his birthday.
Mm.
You know, and whew, you know, we are so blessed, you know, and to have someone in our life that I mean, I've had great parents and I've had great mentors and teachers, and I've been really blessed in that way. But to have someone, you know, I would just say that Roy, everything that I have in my adult life came from him. You know, my friends, my career, my job opportunities, all of these great things. And so it's just great to be here with you, and thank you for sharing that. And yeah, I don't have much to say, but it touched me. It got me.
Yeah, it's his birthday. It's also, isn't it Sri Yukteswar's
Mahasamadhi
today, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
it
right. They shared that same day.
Yeah.
No coincidence there, I would say.
Yeah.
Very similar personalities, those two.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
When I first started studying with Roy, he was very stern with me, you know, and very serious in most ways. And then over the years, that really softened, and we became more like friends. He was always my teacher, but towards the last 10 years or so, he treated me like a friend. Like, we would hang out and we would talk about stuff. But in the very beginning, he was much more like Sri Yukteswar. I'll never forget one time he was feeding us, you know, we were at the hall and he's giving us food. And we all have lunch together, and Roy would often cook the lunch back then. And then he would serve you. You'd stand in line and here's Mr. Davis, and he'd grab the food and put it on your plate. And so I'm there with my plate, and he puts the food on my plate, and he goes, "Do you want some more?" And I said, "Yeah." And he looked at me and he goes, "Mm-mm." Because he was telling me I need to not eat so much, you know, because I have that kapha and I have a tendency to gain weight and these kind of things. And he wasn't being mean or judgmental. He was just helping me along. But that strong sternness, like Sri Yukteswar, was definitely there.
Well, I needed that. You know, I'm a pretty rebellious dude. I, you know, played in a lot of rock bands and stuff growing up, and had that kind of lifestyle for years. And hated authority figures. Still do, you know, for the most part. Hate's a strong word, but let's say I'm not a big fan of authority, authoritarianism, authority figures, yeah, and all that. And it's just baked into the cake here, you know. And so I really needed that, you know. At that time, it was like the perfect time in my life to encounter someone who could give me that discipline that I was lacking, and also to sort of surrender, maybe isn't the best word, but for lack of a better term, sort of surrender my ego and my will to someone who knew better than I did, you know, who
Absolutely.
Knew what I needed much better than I did. You know what I'm saying?
And you had to be receptive. So, you know, it's like you had to sort of let some of that go to really receive.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's yeah, sort of like stern, sort of strict personality is exactly what I needed at that time. But like you said, over the years, as my relationship with him evolved, I didn't need that as much, and he could sense that. And so, yeah, we had more of a sort of a less formal relationship, so to say. It was kind of more of a spiritual friendship, as it were. As it evolved, as I got older and matured a bit and all that, and he sensed those changes, he was able to allow the relationship to evolve to a different place. But it was just completely organic or natural. We never talked about these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And anyway, so it's so wonderful to see all of you out there teaching, doing your thing now, and continuing this transmission, this unbroken chain. And again, it's just wonderful to talk to you. And thank you so much for sharing with me and with my listeners here today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Chris. Good to see you.
Lots of love.